We'll hear arguments next in Federal Communications Commission against the Pacifica Foundation. Mr. Marino, you may proceed when you're ready. You may bear in mind that we're familiar with the facts of the case and get directly to your legal argument if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In this case, the FCC has brought this case to you for review and from a judgment of the court below, an opinion in which the court split in their opinion with Justice Leventhal dissenting, in the hope of getting some clarification to the meaning of the word indecent as appears in the Criminal Code 1464. The FCC has, from beginning in 1970, tried to give some concrete meaning to the statute. The FCC recognized in the very first decision in 1970 that its opinion would, of course, be subject to judicial review, and it welcomed judicial review. This case came to the FCC on a specific complaint from a citizen in New York. The case, as it now is before the court, really raises two issues. The first question of statutory construction is whether or not the indecent, as that word appears in 1464, should be subsumed into the obscene as it has been in several other federal cases. On this issue, both the FCC and the Department of Justice are in agreement, and in their briefs before you argue that it should not be. The Department of Justice, in their brief, makes a very literal statutory analysis of the provision of 1464. It points out that the language, the clear language that Congress used is any obscene, indecent, or profane, that this language was used in a disjunctive, that Congress was obviously trying to reach even the use of one word, which was either indecent, obscene, or profane, although we quickly add that the case we have before you deals not with obscenity, but with indecency. And if I could just back up and focus on the complaint that the Commission had before it. That complaint was filed by a listener in New York. It's a specific complaint which identified four words. Those words would be defined as verbal taboos, and in fact, Professor Hayek Powell in his textbook on language and thought and action identifies them as verbal taboos and says that this usually deals with words having something to do with sexual or excretory organs. The words are amount, and one judge has described them as verbal slaps. This specific complaint came to the commission. It came to the commission at a time shortly after this court's opinion in Miller. It came to the commission shortly after the D.C. Circuit had affirmed its opinion in the Illinois Citizen case dealing with the question of obscenity and had recognized that the presence of children in the audience was a vital factor. And this really was at the heart of the commission's decision. It was at the heart of the complaint that the commission had before it. The listener pointed out that the words were broadcast at a time in the afternoon when a child could have been tuning the dial and would have come across those words. The listener pointed out that in fact he had a child with him in the car. And this really was, we think, at the heart of the commission's decision when it came to the concept of indecency. The commission, as the Justice Department correctly recognizes and points out, took element D of the Miller case, patently offensive, tried to give flesh to that element in a case where you're merely dealing with words and individual words, And what it said is that what we're dealing with when we construe the indecent is words which are patently offensive by contemporary community standard for the broadcast media, which deal with sexual and excretory organs, which are broadcast at a time of the day when there's a reasonable risk that children may be in the audience. And this is where the commission was took a new tack, and we believe, and I think Judge Leventhal recognized this with regard to the place with the indecency standard. It tried to channel these words out of time periods when there would be a reasonable risk of children being in the audience. The case was appealed to the D.C. Circuit, which split. We, in our brief, have called to your attention the opinion of Judge Leventhal. We think that opinion correctly construes the Commission's order as a narrow order, a declaratory order, limited to the facts that the Commission had before it, that the complainant had brought to the Commission. That the order was presented to the court as a flat ban on these words, that these words could not be broadcast at any, really at different times of the day, but that that when it ruled on the complaint itself, the commission narrowed its holding to the facts that it had before it. It tried to accomplish two things with the declaratory order. It tried to furnish a concrete definition of the word indecency. And we must bear in mind that the Justice Department has told the court that the commission could have read the indecent prohibition in the criminal statute as a flat ban. The commission did not do so. It then proceeded to analyze the complaint and the conflicting interests and competing interests that were at stake here. And central to those interests, Your Honor, was the recognition that this court had made in the Yoder case that the parental interest in the upbringing of children is an important value. That opinion the commission found very helpful because of the fact that in Yoder, this court not only relied on that interest, but also relied on the Ginsburg opinion, where Mr. Justice Brennan had recognized a similar interest. The Yoder opinion was also instructive because it relied on at least C.F. the Rowan case, in which this court recognized that in certain circumstances people are captives in their own homes, and that at that point they are entitled to privacy interests. Now, the commission's opinion really, at the heart of the case, was the attempt to protect children from these words. The commission also tried to give some recognition to privacy rights of people in their home who would tune in to a station and be confronted with these words. We would point out that in the CBS versus DNC case, this court recognized that a radio listener is in many ways a member of a captive audience. And I think we've made our points, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I would save some time for rebuttal and be very happy to answer any questions.
You referred to some work of now Senator Hayakawa, but it's not cited in your...
I apologize, Your Honor. It's his text, Professor Hayakawa's text on language and thought and action. There are two editions. Or at least I know of two editions. The 1949 edition is very interesting because it recognizes not only the verbal taboos that are before you dealing with sexual or excretory organ, but goes on to to point out that at least at that time in broadcasting, there were many more taboos that made it very hard for people to communicate. But in the 70 edition, he drops the reference to special taboos applicable to radio and identifies the ones that we think are before you. If there are no further
questions. Mr. Marino,
questions,
I do have
yes,
a question. I take it the commission's position is that these words are indecent but not obscene.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that mean that if this particular record or these particular words are said over, say, a CB radio transmission from an automobile to another automobile or something like that, would the person playing the record or saying the words commit a crime?
Your Honor, the commission's definition and this declaratory order addressed the broadcast medium, which is different
from
the CB.
That. I'm just wondering what the commission's view is on whether that would be a crime if these words, same record, were played same time of day over a CB transmission. The statute would seem to apply to it, would it?
Your Honor, we have a problem here. The Department of Justice looks at that statute with criminal enforcement in mind. The commission looks at the statute with civil enforcement in mind and with an attempt to channel. I think that once the commission has adopted this concept of channeling, at least in broadcasting, it really has to be an egregious case before it would rise to the point.
My question is, under your construction of the statute, would playing this record and saying these words over a CB at 2 o'clock in the afternoon constitute a crime?
Your Honor, I think that if we're looking at this as a criminal statute and not...
It is a criminal statute, isn't it? There is no statute except a criminal statute.
We think that it would violate the commission's construction of the statute, yes.
Well, now, let me ask you again. Would it constitute a crime in the opinion of the Federal Communications Commission? Or do you have a position on that?
I don't think we have a position on that, Your Honor, and I think
take the view that the statute can, the same words in the same statute can mean different things in different proceedings?
If it's for purposes of regulatory action in one case and channeling the words into a different time period, and in another case, really, the reason why I hesitate on the crime is because that's really a question that we would defer to the Justice Department. If we brought a complaint to them and they said this doesn't constitute an offense, that would be the end of it.
Do you have any direct criminal enforcement authority?
No.
Can you bring a criminal
No, we
proceeding?
Can't. We have to refer it to the...
Going to the question about CB, are the CB people licensed in some way? Do they get a license of some sort?
They do, Your Honor.
Would not the... Commission at least have arguably some other remedy against the holder of a license by canceling his license?
Yes, Your Honor. We have administrative or regulatory actions.
Just as you do with a broadcast license at the end of his, when he came up for renewal, this kind of conduct would certainly be a factor to be considered in the renewal of the license, would it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Maria, doesn't the commission consider any number of factors at the time of license renewal that very likely the government couldn't prosecute a station for criminally?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the public interest standard, it would have to be in one violation might not rise to the level of justifying some action at renewal, but yes, it would.
Well, why doesn't the commission justify this particular rule under the public interest standard as a definition of the public interest standard?
Your Honor, the commission has been given at least three sections in the Communications Act. They're all in which Congress has asked the commission to enforce 1464 by administrative actions. And it feels that in a situation where we are reaching a type, at least words, that since there was the prohibition, the indecency prohibition, that was the way to reach it, to try to give it some concrete meaning. In response to Justice Stevens' question, we do refer cases to the Justice Department for prosecution of CB operators, and I think that's really the only area that I know of in which in which there have been any recent convictions for violating 1464. I think there were two cases arising in the Seventh Circuit in which I know you were on those panels where those prosecutions were appealed.
Well, we're interested in Mr. Claiborne's response to Justice Stevens' question.
But I am still, I'm still not completely clear on whether the Commission takes a position that the same statutory meaning can have a different, same statutory words can have a different meaning in a civil proceeding for cancellation or whatever it might be, and also than it has in a criminal proceeding. In other words, can the word indecent have a broader meaning in one proceeding that has in another when it's in the same statute?
As Justice Stevens has pointed out, we have not only the indecency prohibition.
Well, I understand you have the public interest theory, but to the extent that you rely on the criminal statute, do you say that word has different meaning depending on the kind of proceeding that is brought to enforce that statute?
I guess we rely on more than the criminal statute. We rely on the criminal...
But to the extent that you rely on that statute, do you contend that the same word has two different meanings depending on the nature of the proceeding that's brought?
I don't think we could, because Congress wrote the word, and all we're trying to do, Your Honor, is give some limiting construction to it.
But you're not confined to that statute on a renewal of a license, are you, by any means?
We are not, Your Honor. We have the public interest standard. You're absolutely correct. The Commission feels...
The same conduct, the same words, whether they were ultimately found to be criminal or non-criminal, might constitute a basis for not renewing a license, might they not?
The public interest standard would have to be... The Commission would have to make as you pointed out in United Church of Christ, the Commission has to make a positive finding that renewal of this application is in the public interest.
Public interest.
And that finding could not be made in a situation where...
And while it would not be criminal conduct for a licensee to have one-sided programs on racial or political matters, that might be a grounds for refusing to renew their license.
That's clearly held up to now yes, Your Honor.
And the courts that have reached it. Is
yes, Your Honor.
Not so.
So that the Commission could have reached it under the public interest standard, and I think it did rely on the public interest standard, and encouraging the wider use of radio in the public interest. But it felt that since that specific prohibition has been in the statute, it would try to give some concrete meaning to it and limit it as much as possible in the light of this court's opinions in First Amendment.
That is, and you're now talking about 18 U.S.C. Section 1464.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the issue in this case, isn't it?
It's 18 U.S.C. 1464, but it's also in the context of the Communications Act.
Yes, I understand that, but it's the meaning of Section 1464 that's at issue here, isn't it? And the Commission's power.
Yes, as the Commission can use it for record.
Under the statutes that incorporate by reference that criminal statute.
Yes, and it uses that prohibition for regulatory activity.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Moreno. Mr. Plotkin.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I would like to place this case just a little bit into proper perspective so that we'll know what we're talking about, because we are talking about a criminal statute. This case, very briefly, involves a program on a non-commercial educational station in New York with a limited audience, which was a discussion program that was involved on this particular day. It's a regular program on this particular day. The program was devoted to discussion of contemporary attitudes with respect to language.
I didn't get your characterization of this station. What kind of a station?
It's a non-commercial educational station. That means it's a station licensed to a non-profit organization, none of whose activities can be no commercials on it, and its programs are of an educational nature. It's like WETA here in Washington here, the same type of station.
Almost.
If it's a little hyperbole, I was describing the morphology rather than the function, I think. But in any event, this was a discussion program, and on that day, the discussion was devoted to contemporary language. And as part of the program, the moderator took questions, answered questions, and then played this 12-minute segment of a record by George Collin called Occupation Fool, and the particular selection was Filthy Words. And it's a 12-minute dialogue. Before the dialogue was put on, there was an announcement that some of the words on this program may be of a delicate and offensive nature, and those who might be offended by it might tune out for 15 minutes and come back at the end of the program.
You think that leads young people to turn off the program? Or is that intended?
No, it might be an invitation.
Or is that intended to be a come-on to be sure that they'll listen?
It's awfully hard to know, both in advertising and in general. You know, this type might be invitational rather than the contrary. I think on this type of station it is not, because this is not a type of station that's devoted to commercial enterprises. This was not a pandering program. It's not a titillating program. It's a station that does devote itself to the unusual programming, to the highly controversial program, to a wide variety of programming. And while on other stations this type of ad might be a come-on, on this type of station I don't think this is the intention. But I don't think we're dealing with subjective matters. I think we're dealing with objective
matters. And, of course, the child will have to tune in, knows what kind of station.
Oh, yes. Yes, the child was sitting with his father and presumably...
No, I say the average child knows that this is an educational station which has a broad range of programs, all of which. How in the world could a child know that?
How could he know that it's educational?
Yeah.
Well, this particular child, we know very little about him. We only know about his father, who sent in a complaint. But in any event, he sends in a complaint, and Pacifica Foundation answered that this was the work of a social satirist, and that this was intended to have a discussion of the whole subject. The FCC then adopted a memorandum opinion and order. They adopted a memorandum opinion and order as part of an overall proceeding where the commission, in response to complaints from Congress and pressure from other groups, was addressing several different subjects: violence, sex-related programs, and obscene and indecent language. And very interestingly, they talked at great length about violent programs, and they're talking about television as well as radio. They're talking about violent programs, they're talking about sexually oriented programs. And very interestingly, the commission says that while there may be social harm even attributable to some of these things, there's nothing we can do about it, because this is a very delicate area of the First Amendment, and therefore this is the sort of thing we leave to the station's good judgment, to their editorial discretion and judgment. But when it comes to obscenity or indecency, it says it's a different subject, because here we have a statute, a specific criminal statute, 18 U.S.C. 1464, and this statute says you can do something about obscenity, indecency, or profanity that you can't do with respect to violence or sex-oriented material. And it's important to look at the statute. The statute is not part of the Communications Act, but it does forbid the utterance of indecent, obscene, or profane language over radio, whether it's radio, television, CB, any other type of radio communication. And the commission is given specific authority to enforce it either by revoking the license, by issuing a cease and desist order, or by levying a fine. Here they didn't do any of those three things. Here they issued a general declaration which says that we find that these type of words, particularly when children are likely to be in the audience, are indecent because they refer in a patently offensive manner to sexual or excretory activities or organs, and that therefore they should be banned during that period, and that they cannot be redeemed by context. Even though they have literary, artistic, or scientific value, they are banned per se. They do go on to say...
Are you arguing now that this has literary or artistic value?
As a matter of fact, in the overall context, yes, it was, yes. The words themselves may not, but in the overall context, yes, Your Honor.
This is educational, in your view.
The question as to whether it's educational or not was not involved in this case. As to whether it has artistic, literary, scientific value, yes. Even Mr. Commissioner Robinson, who concurred in the case on a very narrow point, said that if he had to judge upon whether it had artistic, literary, or scientific value, he said he would come down and say that it did have it. But he agreed with the commission that you don't look at context when children are likely to be in the audience.
Well, I'm not an expert, but if that's artistic delivery...
Pardon?
If that is artistic delivery...
Well, I think the use of words is a very difficult matter. And obviously some people use words in some connection, other people use them in other connections. I do want to address myself to the statute, because we are talking about a criminal statute. In 1860, and this court had previously held, when the commission had attempted to adopt rules and regulations relating to a lottery, which also was a criminal statute where the commission had the same authority, this court in the Federal Communications Commission against ABC, which is at 347 U.S., specifically held that the commission cannot interpret the words of a criminal statute when applying it in its regulatory aspect any differently than a court would. And this court specifically overturned rules and regulations of the commission which attempted to define consideration for the purpose of a lottery as being different from what it was in the criminal law. Here we have a statute that uses indecent, obscene, indecent, or profane, exactly the same type of words that are used in 18 U.S.C. 1461, which has been before this court in the Hamlin case. And this court has specifically held that it's a matter of statutory construction that when those words are used, the word indecent, filthy, vile, and obscene must mean the same as obscene in order to satisfy the dual test of avoiding vagueness under the due process clause, and must as a whole appeal to prurient interests, and must be without any literary, artistic, social, or scientific value.
To say held may be a little bit of an overstatement, may it not?
Well,
we did not confront the entire section by section of the statute in that opinion.
I have the same problem as my predecessor here, since you wrote the opinion, Your Honor. We now so construe it as to avoid the problem. I think that's as strong as language to a third person as is possible to say. I'm not saying that no other conclusion was possible, but the language is very strong that in order to save the statute, it was so construed.
There's no doubt that the words are there in the opinion. I think my quibble, and it may be quibble, is for you to describe it as a holding, since a holding is presumably the application of the law to the particular set of facts before the court.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right, and technically that was 1461 there, and this is 1464. But the words in the statute are the same. The medium is the same. We have a First Amendment medium here, just as we do there. And it seems to me that not only do we have a First Amendment medium under the First Amendment, but Section 326 of the Communications Act specifically says that the Commission shall have no power of censorship. Now, this is an entirely different thing from the fairness doctrine or lack of balance, where because this is a medium where scarcity is a factor, the Court has said that in order to make sure that the medium is made available to a maximum number of people, we will impose certain duties upon broadcast stations to make sure that all can use it. But that's an entirely different thing from the government coming in and saying that you are forbidden to do something. And in the Red Lion case, which Ms. Justice White authored, you made that very point that whereas the fairness doctrine and the personal attack doctrine might be sustained because it's expanding the medium, had a real caveat that an entirely different question would be presented if the government here were trying to suppress speech. And that's exactly what they're doing here. They are trying to suppress speech. And if they're trying to suppress speech, they must be able to pass the same test here as they do in any other First Amendment meeting. The fact that this is radio does not make a difference.
Well, now, you said the question was reserved in Red Lion, as it certainly was.
Yes.
That doesn't necessarily mean that in the case of regulated airwaves, they have to pass the same test as they would if they sought to impose this test on a newspaper, does it?
I think 326 does mean that, Your Honor. I think not only the First Amendment, but I think Congress is saying that in Section 326, when it says the Commission shall have no power of censorship. When it comes to suppression, I think the same test is applicable to radio and television as is applicable to a newspaper.
Well, then you say literally the FCC can never tell any station that it may not put out any particular message.
I say that they cannot tell a radio or television station that they cannot suppress what a radio or television station can do any more than they can to any other.
Like ads?
I think... Now that ads have a certain amount of penumbra of First Amendment protection, I think radio and television ads would have the same protection as newspaper ads.
This is because of 326.
Because of 326 and probably because of the First Amendment.
Well,
I think
you have to reach that if you're right under 326?
Mr. Justice Tam in the court below did not reach the Constitution. He reached 326. I think it can be decided on 326. I'm not. I think 326 has First Amendment overtones. But I don't think it's necessary to do it, because I think Congress has said that so far as the commission is concerned, when it comes to the area of suppression, they cannot suppress this any more than any other medium can be suppressed.
Well, supposing, under your definition of censorship, that a station just decided that for an hour it would put on a record consisting of one four-letter word repeated over and over again for the hour. No one would make any claim that it had any coherent message. The person spending the power simply liked it that way. Under your definition, would the FCC be powerless because of the censorship statute to effectuate that?
I think they would be powerless to tell them to stop doing it. I would have the same problem in response to your hypothetical question if a station did nothing say but play the music goes round and round all day. It's not because of the content, but because a station is required to operate in the public interest. And if they, one of the doctrines that the commission has announced in the past, that if you don't have a well-rounded program, and if you devote too much of your programming to one aspect and neglect other parts of your programming, you're not operating in the public interest. But not because particular words are bad, not because particular words have a particular taboo. Here the commission is saying that just because you use these seven words, no matter in what context, if you put on a forum where people came in and discussed a live subject, a controversial issue, and if some of the people came from the kind of culture that used this word, these kind of words as part of their discussion, particularly in anger and heat, the commission would say that if you did that during the afternoon, that this would be a violation of the criminal code so far as the commission can see it, and would also would be ground for revoking a license. I don't think the commission has that authority.
Can you justify the coexistence of 1464 and 326?
Yes, I can, to the same extent that I can justify the coexistence of 1461 and the First Amendment. If it's given the same interpretation, this court has held that 1464 is no different than 1461. If it is constitutional for a statute to say that obscene material cannot be printed in the newspaper.
I'm getting away from the Constitution. I'm speaking just on the statute.
Yes,
well,
I don't think
326... You've taken the position just now that 326 was the anti-censorship statute, meant what it said.
Yes.
And what posture then is left to 1464?
I think 326 has to be read in the same light as the First Amendment when it says no censorship. It says no censorship of the material is constitutionally protected. I do not think that the commission, by 326, has less power than the government does, say, against a newspaper. If they have obscene material, if you can prevent obscene material under 1461.
We'll resume there at 10 o'clock in the morning. We'll resume arguments in Federal Communications Commission against Pacifica Foundation. Mr. Claiborne, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, perhaps it's first appropriate if I state as accurately as I can the government's position in this case. It is
the government or the Department of Justice?
The position of the United States, the Department of Justice, Mr. Justice Brennan.
Well, for whom is the FCC speaking?
The FCC was speaking for itself as
not
under...
part of the government of the United States?
I meant the executive branch of the government of the United States, Mr. Justice Brennan.
Mr. Claiborne, what business is it of the executive branch of the United States to take a position in a case like this? Once the petition for certiorari is granted to review an unfavorable decision to the government of the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and this court is going to consider it on the merits, what interest does the government as an institutional litigator have in wanting a narrow construction of a statute enacted by Congress?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, of course, the United States is a statutory separate party and is therefore a respondent in this court. In this particular case, the United States has, or the Department of Justice has, a separate interest because it has an independent responsibility to enforce this statute, quite separate from the Commission's responsibility to enforce the same statute in its regulatory field. It is therefore appropriate, it seemed to us, for the United States to speak the views of the Department of Justice in this case, since it must be bound by the decision
but
of this court.
If this court upholds the FCC, the government will have no problem prosecuting cases under the statute because it will be given a fairly broad construction, I would take it.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, the government, that is the Solicitor General and the Department of Justice, take the view that they should not press for broader prosecutorial discretion than, in their view, the constitutional reach of the statute would authorize. And accordingly, it seems to us that the court ought to have the benefit of the views of the Department of Justice as to the constitutional reach of the statute.
Well, do you think the government is ever entitled as an institutional litigator through the Solicitor General to assert that an act of Congress is unconstitutional?
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, there may be rare occasions when that is so. This is not such an occasion. We do not suggest that the statute is unconstitutional. We suggest that it has a limited application and that the Commission has construed it beyond that constitutional reach.
Is there
can you say the United States is a statutory party?
Indeed, Mr. Justice White. I have cited in the brief the provisions of both the Communications Act and the Judicial Code, which make that clear. Perhaps the clearest provision is that in the Judicial Code, and one finds it in the section 2342, first tells us that all, in paragraph 1 thereof, that all final orders of the Federal Communications Commission made reviewable by section 402A of Title 47, all covered by the following sections. This is such an order issued by the Commission under section 402 of its statute. When we then turn to section 2344, we note that an action brought in the Court of Appeal to review such an order is to be an action against the United States. And it further provides, at the end of that provision, that the clerk shall serve a true copy of the petition on the agency and on the Attorney General. And when we turn to section 2348 of Title 28, we note that the Attorney General is responsible for and has control of the interests of the government in all court proceedings under this chapter. The agency and any party in interest may appear, I'm skipping words, as parties thereto of their own motion and as of right. Primary responsibility in the Attorney General, but independent right of the agency to be represented. Hence here, the Commission, though not joined by the Solicitor General, was authorized to file a petition for certiorari.
Mr. Claiborne, does it occur to you that there may be a difference between the relationship of the Department of Justice to, let us say, the Secretary of Defense, a cabinet officer, and the relationship with what is thought of as an independent regulatory agency, which is not subject in the same way, surely, to the direction of the executive branch?
Mr. Chief Justice, that would certainly apply with greater force in those circumstances where the agency was not free to represent itself before this court, and where, therefore, the Solicitor General would feel a greater inclination to support the independent commission's view, which could otherwise not be presented to the court. When the agency has an independent right to appear here, that consideration is perhaps lessened. This, however, is an unusual case in that the Department of Justice has a quite separate responsibility under the statute and therefore cannot be bound or overly influenced by the views of the Commission as it applies the statute in a different field. And indeed, when this Court decided the ABC case in 347 of the United States reports, the Court relied on the construction of that anti-lottery statute for in the Communications Act, relied on the construction placed on that statute by the Attorney General, and said it cannot have one meaning for the Commission and another for the Department of Justice. We noticed that the Department of Justice does not view these programs as violating that statute. And we're influenced by that in holding that the Commission has overstepped the line.
But there's a difference where the Commission has authority by statute to come in.
FCC.
Like the ICC.
And indeed, the Federal Communications Commission under the Hobbs Act in this sort of case.
Has the same right as ICC?
Has the same independent right, and indeed its petition, which this Court granted, was not joined by the Solicitor General, nor was there...
Well, there are instances where the ICC and the Solicitor General have been direct on in this Court.
Indeed, Mr. Justice Marshall, and there have been instances in which the Federal Maritime Commission and the United States have been at odds, and in the most recent such case, the Court upheld the views of the United States rather than those of the Federal Maritime
Commission. I didn't mean by that to say that was a nice way of doing business or running a railroad.
Mr. Justice Marshall, of course, it is to be avoided if possible. And we, as the Court knows, have joined the Commission in some of its submissions before this Court. We part company at a certain point.
Apart from these background procedural matters, Mr. Claiborne, do I understand this is the station that's involved here is a public, part of the public radio system?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it is...
Supported by the Congress, by funds appropriated by Congress?
Mr. Chief Justice, I do not know whether federal funds are involved, but certainly it uses the public airways. It is licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. It is in every respect like a commercial radio station, except only that it is owned and operated by a non-profit corporation.
And doesn't take commercial advertising.
Doesn't take commercial advertising, and of course is not governed by the profit motive, and for that reason may not be censored, as it were, by a public taste to the same extent as a commercial station
may
would
not be.
May not be influenced by the reaction of a commercial public who might view such material as is involved in this case as distasteful, and accordingly sponsors would not sponsor it and the station would not air it. That consideration doesn't apply with respect to a broadcaster like Pacifica.
Mr. Claiborne, the department supported the commission below, did it not?
Mr. Justice Powell, that is true, and that is an embarrassment to us. It's right to say that the matter was handled there by the antitrust division rather than the criminal division. When the matter came on for consideration of a petition for certiorari, the matter was turned over to the criminal division, and its view, shared by the Solicitor General, was that the judgment below was correct and that review of it ought not be sought, and accordingly we did not petition. We did not oppose the petition, but when the Court took the case, we deemed it our duty to give this Court the benefit of our views.
Mr. Claiborne, our collateral inquiries have taken some of your time. We'll enlarge your time 5 minutes.
I'm most grateful.
So I won't feel embarrassed by asking you another question. Another collateral question. Do you think that Section 2348 is limited to the agencies listed in 2342?
I think that is so. Ms.
Because
Justice
it says under this chapter? What about the National Labor Relations Board?
My understanding, Mr. Justice White, is that the National Labor Relations Board does not have independent authority to...
How does it get into the Court of Appeals? How does the Court of Appeals get authority to review its services? If it isn't under this chapter.
I think it isn't. There must be, and I don't have it to hand, a provision in the labor relations law.
It's an enforcement proceeding in the Court of Appeal.
Which allows the...
It's not... It's different from the technically from the review of the judgment.
I'm
an enforcement proceeding under the Labor Act.
I think so. But I think it's clear, Mr. Justice White, that when it comes to proceedings in this court, a petition for certiorari or otherwise, the Labor Board does not have independent authority to represent itself.
And only the agencies in 2342, now since 1966, have this authority.
In addition, the ICC.
Well, it is listed.
Yes, well, yes, the Federal Maritime Commission.
Federal Maritime, Atomic Energy Commission, Interstate Commerce Commission, the Secretary of Agriculture, Federal Communications Commission, those agencies. You think those are the only ones?
I think those are the only ones which have independent authority to appear on their own in this court, at
least.
And
that's only been true since 1966, except for the ICC?
That may be so, Mr. Justice White. I don't go back any further.
Thank you. I'm sorry to take 1 minute of your time.
In what time remains, it is perhaps useful to say that our position is simply this, that we construe Section 1464, the only statute which we view as involved in this case, as one that cannot, consistently with the First Amendment, be applied so as to ban absolutely, for any substantial period of time, the airing of particular words on radio or television, wholly without regard to the circumstances or to the context. That is the limit of our position.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but I noticed those words in the caveat at the end of your brief, and I wonder really whether you think that's a fair characterization of the Commission's order or its present position. The Commission denies it hotly in its reply brief. Judge Leventhal didn't think that was a fair characterization. Is it necessary to construe what the Commission actually held so sweepingly?
Mr. Justice Powell, I fear it is. Judge Leventhal sought to save the Commission's order by narrowing it, and the Commission rides his coattails. But the order, which is what is before the Court and not their counsel's representation of it, is very clear that the Colling dialogue was not judged except only insofar as it contained certain words. Those words, regardless of how they were spoken, regardless of the manner in which they were spoken, regardless of the surrounding words, were adjudged by the Commission to be indecent language. The definition of indecent language which the Commission gave was clearly one which did not have any relation to the context. They ruled that indecent language could in no circumstances, except perhaps after 10 o'clock in the evening, be redeemed by its context. And accordingly, we see no option but to say the Commission, and to this extent they're to be commended on their clarity in the order, has said straightforwardly, these words, in no circumstances, when children may be in the audience, and so far as we can determine, that is all the time, may be aired. And they did not look to the monologue to see whether, in that context, things might be different. They said, these words recur in that monologue. They are indecent by our definition. And accordingly, that may not be done again.
Mr. Claiborne, assume that this station's license came up for renewal, or that of a commercial station with exactly this record of a broadcast, precisely this, and a coalition of churches, civic associations, parent-teachers organizations intervened under the United Church of Christ intervention procedure. Would you think on this record, if the Commission refused to renew the license, that on that ground and solely upon the ground of this broadcast, as being antagonistic to the public interest, that should be sustained by a court?
Mr. Chief Justice, I have some difficulty with the question, because the question which goes beyond the boundaries of Section 1464. I take your question, Mr. Chief Justice, to suggest that perhaps under a public interest standard, the Commission has some discretion in renewal proceedings and perhaps in judging competing applicants.
They have very broad discretion, do they not?
Yes. I would have submitted, though it is perhaps beyond the responsibility of the Department of Justice to speak to this, but I would have submitted that the Commission may take into account whether the station has devoted a very substantial portion of its programming to a kind of material that did not appeal to a substantial part of its audience, and that accordingly it was not in the public interest to renew that license when other applicants who served more what the general public wanted were there waiting to take the spot. But I would not think it permissible for the Commission to focus on an isolated instance of the broadcast of this monologue and say that bad mark will justify our revoking your license when renewal time comes.
But if they did it once a week for 10 weeks, would you say
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chief Justice, I don't know where the line is drawn, but I do recognize that the Commission must judge between applicants and must be concerned that the station to whom it's granted a license does effectively serve the public interest. And that must mean serving what most of the public within its reach prefer. It does not, however, in my submission, allow the Commission through the back door to censor particular programs by saying, we can't forbid it, but we can take it into account in failing to renew your license. That would overstep the bounds of Section 1466.
Well, is it the position of the Department of Justice that under Section 1464 anything goes?
Mr. Chief Justice, no. We, as we've tried to explain in the last portion of our brief, indicated that in our view, first, if these very words are used in a way which, though not really fighting words because the confrontation is not face-to-face, nevertheless, are used in a hostile manner so as to insult the audience generally or anyone in particular, they may be reached under the Chaplinsky analysis. We go further. And
this would not include any one or more of the words used in a hostile manner by a fictional character, assaulting another fictional character.
Indeed,
would it?
Mr. Justice Stewart, and to that extent, we say it must be judged in context. Right. It depends on the circumstances. Even fighting words, properly so defined, cannot be judged as words. The words fascist and racketeer in Chaplinsky itself are not banned. It's simply that when they're used face-to-face to an individual without a disarming smile, they are likely to provoke a breach of the peace and accordingly may be banned as fighting words. Here we go further and we say that if, and we're concerned here primarily about citizens' banned radio, if someone ill-advised attempted to jam the airways by the use of four-letter words strung indefinitely, we say that sort of spewing forth of indecent language with no conceivable redeeming purpose could be reached by Section 1464 and the indecency provision of it, because it would not qualify as obscenity since it didn't appeal to prurient interest. And it's for that reason that we think there
really... You've left out one part of the statute, haven't you? Indecent.
But, Mr. Chief Justice, I meant to say, if I didn't, that that would be reached under the indecency portion of the statute. And it is for that reason that we think it important to save something of the separate, as we view it, indecency prohibition in the statute, quite separate from the obscenity prohibition, which, of course, survives under the Miller test.
Mr. Claiborne, in view of the standard that you propose on the next to the last and last page of your brief, light of that standard, what would your position be, the department's position be, with respect to this very program, if these 11 minutes were put on the air, let's say 8 to 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, which is prime time for small children?
Mr. Justice Powell, if it could be shown, I don't know that it could, that that was a time peculiarly devoted to children's programming, and that the particular program in which it was included was one aimed specifically at children, we would, as we say in our brief, view that as reachable. No, Mr. Justice Powell, I think we say that in the very last paragraph of our brief, that quite independently of that, any radio broadcast specifically directed at younger children, regardless of the hour, might at least, we think, tentatively be reached under this statute. There are definitional problems about what a program aimed specifically at children would be, and there we would seek the help of the Commission in defining our children's program.
Mr. Claymore, just to follow up on Justice Powell's question, your conclusion, of course, is quite tentative in the last paragraph as I read it. Do I correctly understand that if we were to adopt Judge Leventhal's view and say that all that is before us is the broadcast as, I mean, these words as broadcast, using his limitation, and we only pass on that, is it the department's view that there would not be constitutional power in the commission to prohibit this specific broadcast in this specific time and context?
Mr. Justice Stevens, that would be our conclusion. We haven't addressed particularly what arguable redeeming value there is in the calling monologue because it seemed to us that the commission's order does not address it. But we would point out that that was clearly not a children's program.
Even under its general authority that it relied on as an alternative ground to the statutory ground, you would still say that there's not constitutional power in answer to Justice Stevens' question?
Well, first, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, I would say there wasn't statutory power because of the anti-censorship provision in Section 326.
Right, but as I understand the Commission's order, it also relied upon its general authority, such as it was outside of the statute.
That is certainly so, Mr. Justice Rehnquist. We would say that the only exception to the anti-censorship provision with respect to banning a particular program is what was originally the second section, the second sentence of that same section, that is Section 1424 as it now is. And therefore, anything that's reached under 1464 can be viewed as an exception to the anti-censorship provision. But the public interest provisions do not, in our view, allow the Commission to violate the anti-censorship provision, except only in the sense that if programming is devoted to material that does not serve the public interest to such a degree, that may be taken into account at renewal time, but not a ban. I've exhausted my time.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Marino?
Just two small points, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Yesterday in his argument, Mr. Plotkin, and this morning in his argument, Mr. Claiborne keep referring to the Commission's order as banning, suppressing. We thought the Commission's order makes it very clear that it wasn't banning, it wasn't adopting a flat ban, that it was trying to channel this material to periods when there wouldn't be a reasonable risk that children would be exposed to it.
What was it? A suggestion? I mean, it wasn't an order banning it. It wasn't a fine.
No, it was declaratory orders. And what happened is that we had almost...
It was no more than a declaratory order.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It was the suggestion that the Chief Justice made, his analogy. A citizen came into the Commission and said, these words have been broadcast. Take the station's license entirely away from them because they have abused the public airwaves. The Commission thought that would not be fair to even put him in hearing on
they
that question.
They also thought they'd be violating the censure statute, too, didn't they, if they did that?
326, Your Honor, prevents 326 was written in the Communications Act, and it has two limitations on it. Number one, the commission cannot censor. This section was written in 1927, and at a time when everybody had black...
But didn't you consider that when you were drafting this order?
We did. We're certainly aware of 326. Yes, yes, Your Honor. We're certainly aware of 326. We're also aware of the language that Mr. Justice White put in the Red Lion case about the commission suppressing or preventing people from broadcasting what they want to broadcast. We're aware of 326. We're aware that we're not in a position, for example, of a motion picture censoring board, which can say to a broadcaster, or not to a broadcaster, to a film distributor, bring in your product so we can look at it. That we can't censor. We cannot interfere with the right of free speech by means of radio communication because that's also included in 326. But we would add that when Congress wrote 326, it quickly added at the end of it that it will be unlawful to use any obscene, indecent, or profane language by means of radio communications. That was written in by the same people who wrote the section in 1927. And so when we approach these cases, we have Congress's indication in 326 itself that we should concern ourselves. We not only have that indication in 326, we have it in at least three other sections that we're supposed to be concerned and enforce to the limited extent that we can using our regulatory powers. I want to respond again, if I can, to Justice Stevens' question of yesterday. This declaratory order, Your Honor, was aimed only at broadcasting, which is a medium, and when we say broadcasting, and I think everybody recognizes this, we're talking about television, AM, and FM radio. It did not address the question of CB, which is a different medium, raises different problems. So that the declaratory order was aimed only to broadcasting, and I think there's no doubt about that in the order.
I understand that, Mr. Marino. May I go back to your question of your statement about censorship, Section 326. Is it the Commission's position that if the Commission regards something as indecent, profane, or obscene, in its expert judgment, it concludes that it fits within that category, that then it's entirely outside the prohibition against censorship?
I don't think so. First of all, let me back up and say it's not if the Commission regards it that way, Your Honor. What I wanted to say is that it's very clear from the very beginning of radio communications law that it's really a question that turns on the community in which the station is located. So it's if those words are found to be patently offensive by contemporary community standards in that community, and this is...
Well, that you give us the easy case. If it's unprotected speech, well, surely it can be prohibited.
Then you have the hard...
But I'm talking about the tough case where something is indecent, but yet may be protected, the person may be protected from criminal prosecution for uttering some swear words or something like that. But if it's in the indecent category, are you saying it's outside of the non-censorship category? That's what I... How do you mesh the censorship?
Well, by censorship, I think 326 takes the classical censorship, which was prior restraint, a motion picture censoring board, and I think this was... Let's bear in mind that the section was written in 1927. There had been very few Supreme Court cases, and everybody's concepts of what the First Amendment meant were the Blackstonian concepts. That, first of all, you cannot... That the First Amendment means that you can't censor. Subsequently, this court has said that in a limited category, you can, motion picture censoring board may censor. But that we know that we cannot censor. The problem is that broadcasters have additional responsibilities. Broadcasters have to broadcast in the public interest, and I think that's the other side of the equation.
What about this community you keep mentioning? All I have heard argued here today is one protest by one man with one son. Am I right?
We only received one complaint, Your Honor. That's correct.
Why did you get community action out of one man? He wasn't a mayor, was he?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He didn't speak for the community, did he?
He certainly did, Your Honor. He came in a representative capacity, we think. We've been
Well, what made you think that? You only got one.
Your Honor, the standing...
Do you need the community standing to win your case?
One citizen can raise a legitimate public interest question.
Yeah, but that one citizen doesn't give you the right to say he speaks for the community, does it?
We've loosened the standard, especially in these informal complaint cases, Your Honor. We've loosened the standards to such an extent that we will entertain complaints from one citizen on behalf of this community.
So
we've learned our lesson on
so it's
standing.
Not community.
He purports to speak for his community to the extent that he raises a public interest question or some other question.
And am I correct? If nobody had protested, you wouldn't have taken action?
We wouldn't have known about it, Your Honor, because we just don't have the funds or we don't have even instructions to monitor. So we would have never known about it except a citizen bringing this to our attention.
Well, I suppose one citizen can call the attention of the police department or the fire department to a nuisance, and that triggers the procedures. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's the theory, and Mr. Justice White's opinion in the New York Telephone Company case.
It wasn't a fire.
No, Your Honor.
Was it?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor. But it gave the commission an opportunity to give broadcasters some guidance, and it did it in the context of a concrete factual situation. I want to once again stress, and I don't understand why the United States feels that they have to expand the commission's order to reach constitutional questions when it could have been read very narrowly, as it was by Judge Leventhal and as it was by the commissioners who instructed us to come and seek cert before this court on the basis of Judge Leventhal's opinion, knowing that we were going to rely on that opinion.
Well, as I understand it, the Solicitor General has taken the position that this particular broadcast was protected by the Constitution. I thought that was the answer in response to a question by my brother Stevens.
I don't think...
So even so limited, I think they...
Then they're saying that it couldn't even be channeled. They would channel... I think what it comes down to...
Do you understand their position differently?
They still would say that you channel... I think they said you channel... In response to Mr. Justice Powell, that you channel it out of, let's say, Captain Kangaroo, where you know it's going to get to children. I can't believe that...
Well, that's right. That's quite different from this broadcast.
But what we're saying is that there's a reasonable risk of always reaching children, so it's a question of which is, under the public interest standard, which is the better channeling device. And finally, in conclusion, Your Honor, if I may, I think we may have inadvertently slighted the alternative theory that the commission used in its order. It's contained at page 18 of the joint appendix. And we would also rely on that and rest on that in submitting this case to you and asking you to reverse the judgment of the court below.
Perhaps, if you know, could you clarify what I put in the question to Mr. Claiborne? Is this station itself supported by appropriated funds appropriated by the Congress?
Your Honor,
or is it a public subscription?
It's a non-commercial educational station. I know that going through their license file, there's at least one indication that perhaps they were asking HEW for funds to improve their facilities. But I don't think it's the traditional educational or PBS, if that's the correct term, station, which is purely educational. I think they're non-commercial, and they therefore qualify for educational frequencies. But I don't think they're a government-supported station, other than perhaps the subsidy from HEW if they've gotten it.
Mm-hmm.